Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I begin the show by talking about our cover story and our undercover. Theories which come from my book, When You Can, You Will, and which are the underpinnings of this show. The show being about why we are not all that we are. I'm continuing to play interviews with the graduating class of the FSU Conservatory Acting Program at the Oslo Repertory Theater in Sarasota, Florida, where you can hear what it means to be who you really are. Today's interview is with Danny Jones, and like many of the other students which you have heard if you've been listening, Danny knew virtually from day one that his life was about imagination, about stories, about things which couldn't be but are, and about his being part of that life. Danny's story begins with the wonderful experience of his own imagination and his family's encouragement of that. It's charming. So hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice. With gentle prodding from the voice, oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive. From nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap. Oh,
and welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is all about finding the pieces of ourselves that for one reason or another we had to hide even from ourselves. It is my belief, and if you've been listening, you have heard it every week, and this based on my more than 30 years as a psychotherapist, not to mention my life as a person and observing the other persons I know, that early on in life, we discover that there are things about us which don't work so well in the family we find ourselves in. I believe that it is the primary job of children to figure out who they have to be in their particular system. Maybe you think that we all are just who we are, that children come into this world and demonstrate whatever it is that they brought with them. I don't. There's a wonderful song, I think it's from South Pacific, called You Have to Be Carefully Taught. It's about prejudice. You know, it makes the point that kids don't have prejudices. They don't see color or ethnicity or sex, or they don't see those distinctions. Kind of like dogs don't see those distinctions. But we are carefully taught. And so people who grow up hating, and there's a line in it, you have to believe what your people believe, to hate the people your people hate. I didn't. That's not a direct quote. The lyric is smarter than that. But this is not just true about prejudices. This is true about virtually everything. So again, I believe that it is the child's first and most important job to figure out who they need to be in order to fit in with, to bring the positive reactions, to avoid the negative reactions of wherever they find themselves. And children are remarkably flexible and facile at this. And so we assess it. If I make too much noise, that brings a frown or yelling or ignoring or sometimes, unfortunately, abuse to me. If I smile and say yes, mommy, yes, daddy, to whatever they say to me, whether I like it or not, whether I know it's true or not, then I know that that behavior is going to bring something good. If I say no, mommy, no, daddy, and that brings something I don't want, then I know that behavior is not good. There are systems in which if I say no, mommy, no, daddy, I get rewarded. There are parents who are pleased to see, well, and I know somebody actually who said, well, my kid, he stands up for himself. So that behavior gets rewarded. Whatever behavior gets rewarded in whatever way, either with positive reinforcement or negative reinforcement, becomes a behavior that we focus on or hide. In my book called When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It, I call these decisions the creation of a cover story. That is, these are the things that seem to work in my system. I will present them, demonstrate them, and an undercover. These are the things that didn't go over, that didn't work, that I didn't like the consequences of, and I will hide them undercover. Well, having chosen a cover story and having hidden other things about ourselves undercover, we believe our cover story and come to believe that we no longer own those qualities which we denied. I say in the book, the more your parents accepted you the way you are, the more you can be who you are and the less you have to hide. The less they accepted you as who you basically are, the less you can be who you are and the more you have to hide. Virtually none of us escapes unscathed from that childhood. Virtually all of us are hiding some things about ourselves. I talk more about this in the book, obviously, but I also talk about this in some of the previous shows, at length, actually. So if you're curious about this concept of cover and undercover, and you want to read about it, you can go up on my website, thelynnshow.com. T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E, don't leave the E out of Lynn, S-H-O-W, that's one word, thelynnshow.com. You can email me and say I'd like the book and I will get it to you. Or you can click on the right side of the homepage of my website is a list of categories. And if you clicked on cover story, for example, the show or shows in which I talked about cover story would come up and you could listen to me talking at more length about what it means to have a cover story, how we create them, what cover stories look like. Same with undercover. How you can figure out what you might have put undercover, why it would be important to recover things which you put undercover, how you can do that, and what the obstacles to doing that might be. Again, if you've been listening to the show, you know that the other thing that I do in this show is an interview series called Anatomy of an Artist. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. I do that because in order to do that in our culture, it really has to be who you really are. This is a culture that dissuades the arts, does not encourage artists. If you're an actor or a dancer or a writer or an architect, a fine artist, and if people ask you what you do and you say, I'm an actor, a dancer, a writer, they are quite likely to say to you, but yeah, but what do you do? What's your real job? We are not a culture that thinks that being an artist is a real job. So in order to do it in our culture, it really has to be who you are in order to suffer the slings and arrows, as Shakespeare said. For the last month, I have been interviewing the graduating class of Florida State University's Conservatory acting program at the Oslo Theater, Repertory Theater in Sarasota, Florida. You can hear in all of these interviews, these are people who either knew from day one that this was who they were, or when they discovered it, and last week I interviewed Angela Sauer and Will Little, who discovered it fairly late, but the minute they discovered it, they knew this was it. They were in no doubt. And today I'm interviewing Danny Jones, who knew at least by the time he was six that his life was all about making up stories and becoming a part of those stories. And one of the things I really want you to hear in this, you can hear it in all of them actually, but it comes at the very beginning of my interview with Danny, is the encouragement of his parents. They saw him, and they didn't say, no, no, don't be that. They delighted in that. And that is how you get to be who you really are. Remember I said the more your parents see, accept, like, who you really are, the less you have to hide. And so it's possible for Danny to say, I have no plan B. This is who I am. I don't have to have a fallback position because I know who I am and I will be it. Of course, I play these interviews so that all of us who are listening can hear what that sounds like and wonder, is there something about myself I have been hiding? Is there someone in me who needs expression? Anyway, enough of that. You can hear it so loud and clear in Danny Jones. And so here is my interview with Danny. So I'm here with Danny Jones in the conference room at the Oslo. And Danny has just graduated from the third year of the conservatory at the Oslo Repertory Theater. Mm-hmm. Is this correct?
This is correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And it is clear that anyone who has been through this 3 years is at least hoping to make a life with the art of theater maybe specifically the art of acting, but maybe more than that.
Yeah. I am going to do all that I can. I mean, I've never left myself a plan B, so all of this work is pretty much all I have to do, which is perfect because I love to do it so much. And there's lots of opportunity opening up after this. Already I feel like the world is kind of embracing me in the theater world anyway because of all the people that I've met here. It's been so positive and supportive, and I really hope that that continues as I continue my career.
I hope that for you. So I always ask the same question. How did it start? How did it happen? When was the first moment that you knew, thought, suspected, were attracted?
To theater, acting in general, I started in school when I was in high school.
Wait. No. There was nothing before that? There was no dancing on the table, for your parents? Where did it start? They didn't say, gee, he's so cute. Look, he can mimic the birds or something. No, is it not?
Well, I was always very easily entertained as a child. I remember that my mom would hand me just like a hairbrush in the back seat of our car, and I would be playing with it, like making little characters up all the time in my mind. And I lived right next to a huge plot of woods in Alaska, and would all the time just create a huge world for myself out there. And my sister wouldn't like to play the same games I did because she would have to be in my head to do them. It's a very intricate little world planned out there, mapped out in the woods. And
how old are you?
This is probably when I easily started, like 6 or 7.
Okay, 6 or 7, you're making up these worlds in your mind?
Yeah.
Right? And you know your sister can't participate because she can't see what's in your mind?
Yeah,
is that the truth?
Well, she tried to play with
me
a bunch of times, but I would say, no, that's not...
That's not right.
It would be things like, this is where the orcs live, and then like, my friendly people live in this part of the woods, and we're in dangerous territory in this, and she would never know where we were stepping into next because I spent so much time out there by myself before.
So you were writing little plays for yourself?
Easily. Huge scenarios that would take all day, and I would never come inside when my mom wanted me to because there was so much that didn't get resolved outside.
Are you serious? There was so much that didn't get resolved? That's amazing. So what would you do? I mean, would you pick it up the next day, or it was over when it was over, or do you know?
I'm trying to recall, and I think that I would continue it days and days, and then I would not go outside for a few days or go to school and hang and just play with my friends or have play dates and stuff like that, because we didn't really watch very much TV. It was all it was all outside things. My parents were very big into that, and they would sometimes continue for like a week. I would have this huge thing going outside, and then I would have some resolve before I would go inside, and then I'd come back to it. For sure.
That's right.
And I would always
be
some great warrior, magician, or, and sometimes I like to be the bad guy, too. I make myself a villain outside and hunt innocent people in the forest. Who knows what.
So this is
so
wonderful.
Like so you
no, actually, it sounds like perfect training for an actor.
Yeah,
I mean, it's just, it sounds like, actually what it sounds like, to me anyway, is that you were mining the many things that you could be. And what's so sweet about it is that you didn't seem to. Now, looking back, you've got the adult judgment thing going on.
Yeah, true.
But then you were open to exploring anything that was in you.
Absolutely,
you
shameless.
Shameless. It's great.
And then when I did start to take in things like movies and television and that, they affected me so greatly. I remember being so engrossed in things like The Nutcracker and really having these long conversations about the possibility of giant mice with my mom. that those don't exist, that doesn't happen at night, does it? And my mom played so well to that. Both of my parents did, to my imagination. They would...
They didn't say, don't be silly.
Yeah.
Right?
No. Things like Santa Claus, I remember my mom made up, asked how he could fit down the chimney, like every kid does, and she told me that he could grow and shrink in size, and so I had this thought in my mind that, wow, Santa can be really tiny if he wants to, and so she would leave little sleigh marks on the plate of cookies and little tiny hoof pencil outlines to they were on the plate and really tiny and only ate little nibbles of the cookies.
Oh, she was wonderful.
Yeah, she was very, very pleasant. And I mean, she works as a teacher, and she affected, both of my parents did. My parents is an outdoorsman, also a very athletic but very spiritual man. So he had a lot to say to me about energy between people, and that helps me out a lot, and what it is to actually connect and unify with a bunch of people at once. And so I had a good imaginative childhood, for sure.
Yeah. Well, now this is another thing. This is kind of interesting. That idea of the energy that exists between, amongst people, mm-hmm. and what you can do about that to affect it, or do you want to say just something else about that?
Well, sure. I think the first thing that comes to mind is the way that my father would put it. He is he's very, very smart. Eloquence is not his strongest suit, but the way he would put things like that energy, and he wouldn't even describe it like that. I forgot how he would, but that was the basis of his teaching to me. The respect for rules, because he was so into sports and things, he always has sports analogies, but also he meditates, and I didn't find out that about him until later, though. But he was so, and it attracted me to the type of conversations with people who weren't as eloquent, that had the bold tenacity to say things straight to you rather than having any kind of intelligence that causes so much passive-aggressive nature, you know. And I really attached to those people in theater, too, to take it all the way back, is when things are written from a blue-collar and low point of view, or I have a hard time attaching to theater that is about the aristocracy or, you know, royalty. But only because I like that. I like that
real
summing up that, mm-hmm. that people do, and that's so realistic to how dramatic people are that don't have very much. They find certain outlets in their life that are just, you know, they attach to the most dramatic thing in their life, even though people... It's really not a big deal. I don't know if that makes sense, but
it does make sense. Yeah. But I've seen you play people who are pretty eloquent.
Mm-hmm.
So you clearly can do it.
Yeah. I was a very low reader in elementary school, and my mom tried to suit me up a lot. I wasn't a very strong reader. She uses me as an example in her class a lot for the people who aren't that strong. And I gained the ability very late. I think I was in high school when I started reading novels and actually getting through the imagination of text to my imagination, because mm-hmm. I could see things and think of things very easily. But when I finally started to attach it to text, it's been a hard, rough ride still for me to draw things out of the text. It always has to be me performing it and saying it and really getting visuals on stage where I start to get the depth of it. But
so scripts must be, I mean, it's something of a challenge.
Yeah, certainly for me. It's becoming a lot easier with the training here and how much more theater I've been able to encompass just these last 2 years.
Well, I mean, you've had to, man. You've done so much stuff back to back that you just don't have a lot of time, even.
I feel like it's a muscle that's just gotten stronger. That I'm seeing situations that really matter to a story instead of just thinking up random things off the top of my head. The people here have really honed into how important it is to tell that story.
Okay, all right, let's back up.
Yeah, okay.
So now we've got you at 6 years old and you're making up these
worlds
right. So then did they have theater in your schools?
Very, very little. In elementary school, the first role that I did was this... Got the name of it, but I was a cat who, it was a song that the choir was singing, and I was a cat that, like, was going all over France and stealing food, and eventually it begins this tragic story where he gets kicked by this tenant off out of a window and tragically dies.
Oi!
I know, it's elementary school, but I guess everything was funny leading up to that, and his angel comes back, and then whatever. And then I also did a few farce things where I was like Snidely Whiplash, you know, and like twirling the mustache things when I was in elementary school. But otherwise, I was very blessed that when I went to high school that I had they did have a good theater program. But the community theater there wasn't the strongest as far as, there were no like children's theater programs, at least when I was there. There are there now, but in Wasilla. But the outlet kind of came at the best time in my life, though, because I really didn't... I was so mediocre at sports, and my dad put me into a lot of sports, and I had a fun time at it, but I had never was any good, and I had... And
you didn't feel bad about it?
No, I didn't feel bad about it at all. When I finally found theater, though, realistically, for one, there was beautiful women everywhere, and it's like all these sports teams, all guys, and I was just like, I'm not very good at this, and I'm really like hanging out with these types of people. But then I went in there and found out like what it is to make people laugh and be on stage, and yeah, and part of it was definitely that there were, I was like, there's this pretty girls all in this theater, and I was good at it. So.
And you are good at it. Okay, so that's high school, right?
Yeah, that's high school.
Okay,
yeah.
So then essentially you said, finally found a spot for myself, huh?
Mm-hmm.
And then?
I went to New York. I went to New York my junior year of high school with a group of people, and I promised myself on that trip that in 4 years I was going to come back and go to New York and become an actor, because I saw this, I saw a lot of great theater, but it was the mainstream stuff that I just hadn't been able to experience in Alaska, like Rent and Les Mis, and I got to see Proof with Mary Louise Parker, and it just opened me right up. I realized that you can do this, and this is something that I know I can do, and progressed from there. Just made a plan, and that's when I also talked to my mom about not having the plan B. I think you just have to go and only do that.
Who said that?
I did. I made that choice up for myself, and my mom was supportive of me, too.
She didn't say, oh, no, you have to have a plan B.
No, she didn't. Well, my dad was a little bit more tentative about it, but he got on board once he realized my talent also, mm-hmm. and even more so when I got into the college spectrum. I mean, I've been in educational theater this whole time. I really didn't have any other outlet professionally until I got here, so. Mm-hmm.
So did you went to college?
Yeah, I went to my undergrad at the University of Alaska Anchorage, and that program is good in that if you do have a serious nature about acting and a shred of talent, you get so many opportunities. When I joined that, I was able to play these lead roles as a freshman. I didn't have much competition because the professors who are great there realized my potential and really utilized me, and so it was just this... I had to do all these great parts, Thomas Cromwell, and like all these student projects. I became the theater
club president. The go-to guy, right?
Yeah, I got to do a thesis project of my own in Pillow Man. They gave me a lot of leeway, anyway, and I became kind of a flagship for a lot of the actors in that program too, to like attach to and realize what it is to.
Okay, but it also sounds like you had every reason to believe that this plan was a viable plan.
Yeah.
Right?
I was getting support and good feedback from all directions. And I never stopped realizing that there was something to work on. I mean, like I said, it was a good program, but it also left a lot for individual motivation, like self-motivation. If you weren't going to do it yourself, it was nothing like here at the conservatory where they're so finely tuned and looking at you in every aspect of your person and body and artistry. There it was kind of like, if you're not going to try, then that's kind of...
Well, it's like the you'll rise or you won't,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to push you up.
No.
Right.
And they don't do that here, but they do expect a lot more of you.
Right.
It's like,
okay, but you've been motivated from the beginning, right? So you did everything, I'm making this up, but it seems to me you did, in undergraduate, you did everything you could.
Yeah. I didn't get to act during the summers. I would commercial fish during the summers to make money for undergrad, and then I'd come back and just do school theater. I did like one or two outside projects for the most part, though. I was very loyal to the theater that I worked at, and because everything was available to me there. And I just did it all myself, with the guidance of these great people, too, that I got to meet there. But ultimately, it wasn't the pocket of people that were challenging me enough.
So that's
why I jumped to the grad school move.
Did you know you wanted to come here, or you were just, you auditioned around a lot and you got this? And
I auditioned at the ERTIS and got a lot of great offers from there. I ended up getting 13 offers, which was unheard of, which I'm not to toot my own horn, but it was just a mind-blowing day of interviews, because we only have one day after you interview, and I had 15 interviews. half an hour back to back, and that was just incredible. I remember going into one of, it was like the Blue Man Group audition, and I knew I wasn't going to be a blue man, so I took up half of the time of their time. I was like, I'm sorry, I have to go to the bath. And I just like freshened up. I was sweating from walking the stairs and just like drank water and sat in the bathroom for like 10 minutes. Then I went out there. And it's like, sorry, nice to meet you, and hopefully I'll see you again later. But then I was thinking about Penn State, and Actors Theater of Louisville also offered me an internship, and so I got a really good support from that, and then FSU gave me an offer, and I have a friend who went here, Brent Bateman, who I'm going to hook up with in New York when I go, had all these great things to say about it, and I remember deciding to come here. At the time, I lived on this highway, which was like one of the top 10 most dangerous highways in America, because it's right next to the ocean. It's in Alaska, and it's just icy. And I was going down it. It was a whiteout. I was going 25 miles an hour on it, and it's usually 55. And I was white-knuckle grabbing the steering wheel, and I was just like, that's it, I'm going to Florida. This is it. So like, no more snow. It's a great program. Why are you even thinking? It's been beautiful. It sounds so superficial. No, it was like the women in the weather. I guess it's the sun.
The essentials.
Yeah. Right. I need that work.
Right, right, right. Okay, so you came here.
And then I came here.
And so how's it been?
Wonderful, wonderful. It's everything that I asked for concerning people that challenge me. My first year here, I have never been rocked that much by the teachers and the sheer magnitude of what it is to be around a repertory theater, the machine that it is. I had no idea what that was before. I had heard of repertory theaters, I kind of knew, but to actually be in the midst of it is incredible, incredible. And so that right away just made my eyes pop, and I worked my butt off, though. It was a lot of self-motivation still, but it was starting to come from a place that wasn't trying to impress anybody else.
Yes.
They brought it to me where it was very much like we could, it's not that they could, that's a bad way to put it, not that they could care less, but that we're going to pose all these things to you, all these ways you can work, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. They almost put it you systematically of things that you could just work on every day. And to do that, to put yourself through that the first year is huge, especially because you have this process that you worked with before, and it's being completely contradicted. So you feel like you don't know who you are in the first year. I mean, that you can see them walking around. This third year has been funny to watch everybody. The first year you see them just walking in a daze. It's really insecure, looking down and just moving their eyes around all the time. Thought-provoking thing. And they're so supportive, too, that they can't wait to be where you are as a third year. And I remember the same feeling. I remember watching them like, how are you so relaxed? And, okay, then you're... sense of self must come back in the third year. All right, that's good. So I just had a muscle through this year. And it taught me so many great things, just to put yourself through the gauntlet and knowing that there's a finish to it. I'm so much more impulsive as an actor on stage and organic, and I change things from night to night, but nothing too drastic that it throws anybody off. Mm-hmm. It's that kind of, I found a balance between it. And that's also the second year training, too. I actually got to work with all of them again. And not to quickly move past all that, but the repertory has been excellent because I feel confident enough now where I've been able to mesh everything that they've taught me into my own process, where I take little bits and from everything that I've learned, and it's created this new beautiful thing that works for me, mm-hmm. that I feel comfortable with, and I've been able to tackle some great projects this year. It's been wonderful. 12 Angry Men.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Yeah,
you were wonderful.
Thank you.
You were so wonderful. Oh, my God.
I was blessed to get moved up to Jurors 7, mm-hmm. the baseball fan.
Mm-hmm.
That was incredible. I felt very, very bad for the person who didn't get to do it, because to tackle it fully was huge. I remember the first... it was 2 weeks from opening, and the first rehearsal that I got in there, I had memorized over the weekend. We had 3 days off, and I just, like, plugged away and got everything memorized. And the first one that we did was a run-through in front of Michael Edwards, the artistic director. And we got to the point where every one of the jurors has to say, all right, we're doing open ballot, guilty, not guilty. So he calls off your juror name or number. You know, 6, not guilty. So at 7, I'm supposed to say guilty, but I had the frame of mind of my old character, and I said, not guilty. And David Howard comes back at me like, make up your mind! Improvises right away. And I'm just shot off guard, and I like look at Michael, I just lost my composure, and finally said, oh, you know what I meant, guilty, of course guilty. And I sat down, but and Michael comes up to me afterwards, puts his arm around me. Now, what's the worst fear you have in doing this show? It's saying the wrong, saying not guilty. And Frank Galati was amazing to work with. He is the person I want to be in theater in a lot of ways, especially his personality and his knowledge. He's so well-read and so compassionate. He is, I think, one of his best qualities is he's just a good audience member. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can hear him out there. He's the only person in the room with a group of men who are, like, pouring their hearts out, and he's just there with you every moment of the way. He's gasping, he's laughing, he's crying with you. Oh. He's so ready for you to make any move. And he embraces so much. He embraces bold moves and just subtly kind of, it's like pushing a raft in water. You kind of like, that's the way you need to go. Like, you'll just say it in a nice way. He'll quote Faulkner all the time. You know, he's a brilliant, brilliant man. And I had the pleasure of having a bunch of private conversations with him about the character in which, you know, he keeps complete eye contact with you. And wow. It's like he wakes up every day and decides he's going to give a little bit of himself to everybody. That's Frank Galati in a nutshell. And that's not to take away from the other two projects that I had, to be honest. Speak about being around people who inspire you. Danny Shea in Labette. I had the pleasure of being in the rehearsal hall with him and Michael, who they've been working together for ages. And their dynamic taught me a lot about both of them as people, while also just the comedic ability of that man is outrageous. Yes. He was killing us. And they talk about that comfort that you have in a rehearsal room next to on stage, and it was so potent in that. I mean, there were some things that Danny Shea did in the rehearsal room that taught me so much that he never did on stage. And that's not to say anything against him as an actor, but you could tell, I mean, it's just a message to all of us that when you have that kind of comfort,
lots of things can happen
mm-hmm. that you never even realized. And you could see that later in his run once he got more comfortable with the role on mm-hmm. stage.
Right.
It just opened up like a flower, and then, you know, he just, everyone was enjoying that. And
Jason Bradley said, after the opening night of The Innocents, I said, so how are you? He said, oh, I'm so glad this is over. He said, opening nights are like weddings. They're for the audience. They're not for us.
That's true.
Okay, I could do it. No, that's over.
Yeah, it is.
You know?
I've always thought that kind of tragic about opening nights, that's when everybody comes.
That's right. And
you're kind of like shaking in your boots. Right. The best people that are at it are the ones who keep their cool opening night and just go through the motions.
Right, right. Do what they can.
Yeah. I mean, that's so much of this repertory feeling is all these quick decisions, quick choices, and things feel like they're just being pushed at this faster pace.
Well, they are.
Yeah,
right, they are.
Like,
and so you do, you get to grow into it, but not necessarily to show what you've got at the beginning, right?
Exactly. It's everything later in the run is always better. Well, I can say that about any show,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, I think that's true about across the board, not just here.
Not just repertory theater,
every
show as you go along.
Right.
I had the unique opportunity recently with Danny in the Deep Blue Sea, where it's a really interesting theory on performance that the first-year teacher, Andre, proposed to me a few times, but I never had the guts to do it, where we would just memorize the lines neutrally together. Katie Cunningham and I did that, and we never really performed it. So we would just memorize and think about
the
circumstances, just run the lines, and then the first time we're going to do it ever is going to be in front of the audience. And that had an emotional depth and a creative depth that I hadn't felt before, too. So there's something to be said about exhausting the situation, you know, and you'll hear a lot of artists and actors talk about that once it gets close. Like, you're in tech for a show,
right,
and you feel like you've just beat the show to
her,
death,
right, right,
you know, because you've run it so many times. That's only sometimes. There's some shows this year where it's just like, we have to keep performing this. especially the ones where you feel like you're going to get tongue-tied a lot. But
there were a lot of shows this year with a lot of words.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, Labette is just a monster.
Yes.
Oh, my God. So I had Danny the Duke Blue Sea went smashingly. It's one of the best feelings I've had on stage in a very, very long time.
I'm really
time.
Sorry I missed yes. it.
Oh, it was Katie Cunningham, too, up-and-comer. Keep an eye out for her. She's a powerful, powerful force. And when I saw her, I've been wanting to do that production for years, and when I saw her work, she was perfect for it. So, and she was willing to take the plunge of just memorizing and performing, and we were very proud.
Wow,
of it.
Very
we only got
proud.
To do it three times, though, so I can't even imagine where it would have gone. But, yeah. all of that said, though, Las Meninas also was an interesting process. I really was happy to work on Lynn Nottage's play a
mm-hmm.
lot. It's, I understand why it's not done very much, and it's not like I don't like the play, but it's an extremely difficult story to tell.
Yeah.
Only because it's posed like a movie. You're in this woman's memory the whole time, and Michael did a beautiful job staging it, and the work in it is fabulous, but I still am having a hard time getting behind how everything connects in the story, still all the way through. But I'm sure that there's something there, because there's a catharsis and a definite emotional reaction that the audience has to it. So
mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a beautiful play.
Not being able to put it into words is just fine. All right, I'm okay with that. I'm not like hating on the play, but I'm just like, there's just something there that I can't get. And that's probably just me and the text or something.
It doesn't show in the performance, so don't worry about it.
Yeah, I'm not. I'm definitely not worried about the show. It's
right.
Beautiful and so, so emotionally available. I'm so proud of my classmates in that opening night when they all three of Devereaux and Will and Lindsay got to move ahead, you know, and do their standing ovation bow. I just got so broken up. It was just a beautiful thing to have see them go through these 3 years and then to have that beautiful moment.
You know, I haven't asked this of anybody, but it just occurs to me now. You have gone through so much together.
Mm-hmm.
It's not easy, right?
No,
and
certainly.
So there must be this bonding thing.
There is. There's extreme bonding. They become like your family
yeah,
in every
right,
way. That
right.
You love them, but you didn't get to choose them.
Right. right.
You know, it's that we. Especially this class, as far as I haven't been in the midst of other classes, but there were so many strong personalities, so many. I mean, that's true with every class, but this one was aggressive strength. They were very powerful on stage, and very powerful socially. And we were our first year very mean to each other actually, because we were so bluntly honest and you know, we didn't care if we weren't doing quality work. We were going to tell you if we thought you weren't doing quality work. It was very hard on us and on the professors. There was a lot of flack that we caught about, you guys need to be nicer to each other.
Really? So but, they were trying to get you to tone it down. I didn't.
Yeah. Well, they did. There's the word ensemble was tossed around endlessly, and how we needed to become an ensemble. And
you weren't.
We weren't.
No,
in
no,
a lot I... of ways. And we've become one. We've become an ensemble now that we've been through enough. But it took us a long time because we had a very aggressive quality to us. Our class had teeth, you know. I'm now the oldest in this group. We've lost a few of our classmates, but once we lost those two, things cinched up. And I don't think it had anything to do with them in a lot of ways, but for some reason, once that those two did leave, it did tighten up. I think it was, we all finally started to take ourselves a little bit more seriously.
Or maybe a little less seriously.
Or maybe a little less, which is probably, I think the people that were left were finally saw enough of, I don't know, how to either get booted or to calm themselves down, and that we do really love each other. And I was broken up when we lost those classmates, because they were at that point very family, like family feeling to us. But this year has been great, I have to say. That now we didn't have to spend all day in the classroom together. We're all very good friends.
Well, okay, so you're going to go to New York now?
Yeah. I have a meeting on the 24th or the 27th with some agents this month, and I'm going to New York in September after I commercial fish this summer again.
Mm-hmm.
To
make some, a little money,
make
right?
Make some money to move over there. Going to Cordova, Alaska for 4 months. And then New York. So hopefully I'll land an agent or at least get some more interviews after that.
Mm-hmm.
And then go on audition and live off the money for as long as I can and then get a job. And who knows
what. And who knows, right.
And it's all history. So, or not history, but it's all whatever.
No, it's right ahead of you.
Yeah, it's all ahead
of me. It's the plan, right? It's plan A.
It's all in the air.
It's all in the air. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to ask if there's anything that you want to say about what it's like to have chosen this, the dedication to this work without a plan B, you know? Just if anything occurs to you that it's about deciding to live this life.
They ask us that at the beginning of this program, and it's really hard to put into words why I do it. There's a definite love I have for it. There's a definite message that I like to send with the acting that I do, and that is that when you hear truth, you know it. And I think I decided that because there aren't always transcendental stories to be told. There are good ones, you know. There are, not every play that you get into is going to go and make someone do something else. It's not all this
change someone's life, right?
Change someone's life. You know, sometimes it's just a story, but the point behind it becomes in telling it truthfully, I think, or at least in the style that it's told. And that's my main goal. But why I decided this life is honestly because I don't feel like I have any other choice. That's really, I mean, it's a sappy, but that's really the way I feel about it.
I don't think it's sappy.
I don't feel like there's anything else I could do or would want to do. I mean, it's becoming less romantic, though, right, lately. It's been less like, oh, this art I'm going to make and all this, you know, this future of changing myself and other people. It's more become that I know this is my job.
Right.
That this is the thing that I love, and I love the working with the people on it and being open and closed to ideas and the visceral feeling you get when you realize what another person was saying in their words, all that, you know. It's
you love the process.
Yeah, I'm a sucker for the answer, you know. I like
oh, it's that resolution. I'm not coming in until it's resolved.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. You know. So you're always aiming for that.
Yeah, at least searching for that.
And it's been here since you were six, right? It still is.
Mm-hmm.
It's in a way what's driving you. That's great.
There's always so much to learn. It's always every play I get into. I mean, I just learned about so much more about the French court and what it is to be a Byzantine nun and all that. You know, the farther I look into it, especially this historical place, there's so much to learn about myself as an actor and what I can do and can't do. I've had a few projects recently. I was like, I don't think that's my style, or, you know. So.
What, for example?
Oh, well, I'm not very keen or good at musicals. I don't have a singing voice that has that kind of quality, and I'm a very, very... I'm not a perfectionist, but it's close to that. You know, if I do something, I want to be able to
do it well.
Its full mm-hmm. potential. And I don't know. There's a few things. I recently did a reading. Some of the people all the time,
mm-hmm.
and I felt like it was a metrosexual gay character. It was very sassy and sarcastic, and I didn't get to work on it fully, and maybe I could encompass that person better, but I had a very hard time attaching to it. And also, people in power positions, and I played Creon this year. It was a very difficult thing for me to attach to, because I had such a superficial look at it, as far as what it means to be militaristic, and I just got loud. I remember just screaming everything, and I felt like that was the right idea for so long until I realized the potency of what it is to be gravely serious and silent and, you know, all
yeah.
that. So, and, you know, the more time I spent with it, I feel like it got deeper, but I never really connected to that one completely, I don't think, because I'm not that... too. I relate a lot of the work that I do to people that I know, which is kind of, it can hold me back sometimes, but other times it opens up a lot of doors for me.
Well, the more people you meet, the more...
Yeah, exactly.
See, now, I saw both of those, and I thought you were fine in some of the people.
Mm-hmm.
I thought you were fine.
Bruce in Mr. Green 2 was fine. I enjoyed
you
that.
You were great.
I connected to
you
that.
You were great. You know, yeah, you were great.
That was just fine.
That was a guy you know.
Yeah, certainly mm-hmm. a guy I know. And see, that's kind of my point, was like when I can relate it even just a little bit, it helps me immensely.
So you're a person who's apparently always going to be a work in progress.
Yeah.
It's lovely. It's lovely, and it's a great place to stop. Thank you, Danny.
Yeah, thank you very much. This was great.
And so you hear once again the message that I hope you hear in every interview that I do. I do this because I don't have a choice, because it is who I am, because there's nothing else I could do or would want to do. That's the hallmark of I am who I am. This isn't a cover story. I'm not pretending to be this person so that it'll work in the world. In fact, I've chosen a difficult thing to do, something that may or may not work in the world, but never mind. It is who I am. What you see is what you get. In psychoanalytic terms, that's called congruence. I'm not at odds with myself. Me and myself are all on the same page. And the other thing I want you to hear that I hear over and over again from this graduating class is not only am I doing this because it is me and I have no choice, but I want to do something meaningful. I want to be able to change people's lives. I believe that what I do changes people's lives. And as Danny was saying, even when it's a piece of fluff, when it's not going to change anyone's life, although if you were listening to Angela Sauer, you know that she believes that just the joy, just going out of the theater feeling better than you came in is the changing of a life. But Danny adds even another piece to that, and that is, okay, it's not maybe going to change someone's life, but they will hear truth. They will know truth when they hear it. Truth. In a way, that's what this show is all about. The truth about you. Knowing the truth about ourselves when we hear it. There's really no way that I can say how important I think this is. You know, as a psychotherapist, I am constantly talking to people who want to be something that they think they're not, or want to stop being something that they think they are. And inevitably, the thing they want to surface is already there. They don't have to find it or become it or develop it or create it. It's there undercover. They hid it from themselves 20, 30, 40 years ago. They forgot that they had it. That's the difference between what so many of us are struggling with and what people like Danny and his fellow acting students are not struggling with. They're going to have to struggle with the world and whether the world will find a place for who they are. And that, I don't want to undermine that. I mean, I don't want to make light of that. That's a huge difficulty, problem, pain, right? But they're not fighting with themselves. They are who they are. And in Danny's case, it's very sweet. There isn't even a plan B, right? This is it. Hopefully the world will honor that choice. Certainly Danny has the talent for them to do it, but as we all know, and as most of them have mentioned, that isn't the whole enchilada. There are other criteria which is out of everybody's control. Criteria, that's plural, isn't it? So that would be criteria which are out of other people's control. Never mind, of course, grammar isn't my strong suit. So, Danny, yet another example of the amazing work that's being done at the FSU Conservatory Acting Program at the Oslo Repertory Theater in Sarasota, Florida, where I am grateful to live. Well, the other person I always need to talk about in these shows is the indomitable Josh Hackney, who knows everything there is to know about recording, computers, Word 7. And if he doesn't know it, he knows how to find it, and he can walk you through it or come and fix it. And if you want to know anything about any of these things, you want Josh Hackney, and you can find him by going up, as I said earlier in the show, on my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow, where you can email me and say, I need Josh, where you can listen to the other shows. You can listen to this show again if you want to, where you can get the book. And if you're interested in the songs that begin and end this show, they are also mine, and the CD is up there. Just anything you might want to know about me and any question you might want to ask me can be asked by going to the website. You can also follow me, as I forget often to say, on LinkedIn, on Twitter, on Facebook. I'm on Cloudcast. And hopefully soon on iTunes. Please comment anywhere, everywhere. Let me know what you think, what you'd like me to be doing. If you have any personal questions, if you want to come into therapy with me, that's all on the phone. Okay, I think that's about it. So, as always, I hope that you heard something that you can use in this show. Something you knew or had forgotten, something you didn't know, something that amused you, interested you, titillated you, annoyed you, anything that might bring you back, because, as always, I will be here next week, same time, same station. Next week, I'm playing We Hold These Truths, which was, if you were listening last month, the radio play that Norman Cousins wrote for the 150th anniversary of the Bill of Rights, which was then broadcast again for the 200th anniversary of the Bill of Rights. And I'm playing it for my July 5th show in honor of July 4th. And following that will be the last interview I did with a graduating student. That will be Lindsay Tears. So I hope that you will come back. The We Hold These Truths is unbelievable. And, well, I hope that as I will be here, you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure. I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. won't go with a whimper.